Well, hello, friends. You caught me making preparations to do some time travel. This is my time machine. Now you've seen it. Maybe you're just hearing it, but this is how I travel through time. And I've had to make some calculations because I've got to bring you back to New Jersey for my Monty Hall performance in 2016. And to do that, I've got to program this machine. Oh, all these dials and things. I don't know how to calculate it. I've been trying to figure out March 2016 on this device. You go, well, that just looks like a tape measure. It's deceptive, isn't it? It's a time travel gauge device or something it's called. And it's the writing is so tiny I can barely make it out. Time travel is not for the old because they make the numbers so small. I don't know. I hope I get this right and I get you back to the right time. Who knows what we could see at Monty Hall, but all the shows are good, so you're not going to miss out. But I think I'll be able to calculate it. I've done this for a long time now. I've been able to travel through time. There's certain rules. A lot of people who haven't done it don't know it. For instance, it's like a colonoscopy. About 3 days before your time travel, you're supposed to not eat any nuts. Cut all that out. And then the day before your time travel, you have to drink this stuff. Oh, it's awful. Why is that? They say, oh, well, there's no toilets in the future. That's bunkum or hokum or bunk hoke or something. But it's wrong. That's not why you do it. It has something to do with the digestive system traveling through time. I think your intestines go at a different rate or something. There's 32 feet of intestines, and not all of them make it on the trip. I think that's part of it. So some of you always stay behind, a little of your gut. People say, oh, I left my heart in San Francisco. Not just. I left also some of my colon is there now, I'm pretty sure. You'll recognize it if you stumble upon it on the street. What's this? It'll be poking out through a hole in space-time. And you'll go, ooh, what is that? Is that some kind of street art? That's just a little bit of Hardy's colon right there. Don't touch it, please. Owie. You could perforate it. Be very careful. You never know when some kind of organic material poking out of a wall isn't someone's organ, some time traveler's organ. So don't ever stick anything on it or draw on it with a Sharpie or anything like that. Another thing you want to take when you time travel is a lot. It sounds like I'm making this up fully, but it's really real odor spray because there's an aroma that goes with time travel. Some people say, oh, it almost smells like natto. Like Japanese natto that people have for breakfast. And that's a fermented soybean dish that they enjoy in Japan. What is the equivalent here? I guess maybe a lot of people like to mix their Lucky Charms with sewage. And I guess that's the equivalent. How many people eat that for breakfast now? I don't know. Another thing is Scrapple. Maybe. I don't know if you're from the Philadelphia area. Hey, shout out to all my friends all over the globe. Y'all eat all different things. That's why I enjoy traveling. And it's one of the reasons that I came to New Jersey, because you know the old adage, if you're going to travel, all trips start inexplicably at New Jersey. I don't know why that is. I think it was supposed to be the center of all things during creation. And something happened. I don't know, when they contacted the New Jersey Transit Authority, they were like, we can't work with these people, said the creator. And they eventually it moved on. And now it's some intergalactic place that I don't ever frequent. And I'll tell you why. This is not I'm not being snobby or anything. Just not my people. My people are from Earth. And I love Earth people. Oh, it's so good to actually physically see you. Not only am I talking to you, you're seeing how I sit in my time machine. Just looks like you're in a basement of a suburban home. Not true. You got to remember, Doctor Who had his look like a police call box. Professor Kronotis, his looks like a Oxford Don's office. That's the nicest time machine. And mine looks like a 50s basement, which I think is great. But I almost spoiled the surprise for you. You saw it there. It's my friend Penny. Hey, Hardy, maybe I could be of some help. Hello, Penny. It's so good to see you, and all my friends are here, too. Hello, friends. I'm Hardy's friend Penny. Penny, I love it. Are you going to come along the trip with me? Yes. What are you doing? I'm practicing my jogging. Jogging? Why is that? I feel like there's a pun coming up.
Because I got an ink disease. Doctor says I got bad ink, and if I don't exercise, it's going to all dry up and coagulate.
I don't think that's a word.
It is. And then I'm going to let something happen, and you won't be able to use me anymore. And the only way that I'll work is if you take a match to my ball.
Ow. We don't want to have to do that.
All right, I'm going to go rest in the pencil case. All right, Penny, I'll see you. Bye.
It's like she's going downstairs. Look. You say, I can't see. It's not video. Did you ever turn the dial too much on the radio and you go over to Channel 6 or something? You go, I'm hearing Telemundo or I'm hearing something like that. It's not supposed to be on the radio. It's a TV show. That's what this is like. Say, I'm hearing it. I think there's a video component too. Oh, there is. Look at this. There's nothing going on in the video too. I'm deceiving both of you. Both audio and video and audio video people, or AVs, we call them. People are, that's to say, I'm avid. That means you can't stop watching TV. I can't stop traveling because I like to meet people. That's the only way you meet them, because they're saying, I'm not coming to you. A lot of times they'll say, all right, well, I will come to you then. That's not a problem. It is a problem because it costs money a lot of times to fly. I did not know this. I thought that it was a right. An inalienable right. It is not, apparently. It is a privilege. And there's different classes of people, too. I didn't realize that. I'm what they call Zone 2, which is the lowest of all people. And we will do, in the future, we'll be divided up into that. Say, are you Platinum Medallion? I'm afraid not. Well, then I can't marry you because my family's Platinum Medallion and your family's Zone 2. That's all right. I'll just say one thing about Zone 2. You ain't leaving until I'm on board. This is the fact. Sorry. Bless your heart. You get to sit in the uncomfortable seat longer. So I'm not trying to spin being the lowest caste of travelers, of the traveling people. There are really people called the travelers. I think they're Irish gypsies or something. But that's not the kind of, I'm travelers with a small T and a really large V. And then the E is actually a 3 backwards. That's what kind I am. But now I look at my window at the beautiful trees and I'm reminded of what happened in New Jersey. Now we're going to see it in a minute. Why am I not seeing it now? I'll tell you why. I left out an entire vignette, the punchline of which is, you didn't ask. I don't think I told that one. I might have. I don't remember. It's all a blur. I was, the visit, now it hasn't happened yet because I've got to go there in the time machine. That's all very confusing. How do you keep track of that, Hardy? Well, there's an app I have on my phone. It said, it's called When Do I Do That? And it helps time travelers sort out, like, did I do it already? Am I supposed to do it? Because a lot of things I think I've done, I go, oh, yeah, jury duty in 2012. Oh, dang it, I actually haven't done it yet. So, you know, that kind of thing. You think it's over, birthdays and everything. So I've got to keep track of that. And it turns out, I've got to be speaking to you in just a few minutes. So I only press a button and I'm there. I just got to get into my suit. What's that going to take? Like a few minutes? I will tell you this. I was backstage with station manager Ken, and he was covered with feathers. And we were talking about that. I said, you know, this part didn't happen. There's an African expression to cover me with feathers. All right, I want to get out of here. Make me into a bird. Cover me with feathers. And he said, I'm really, really deeply uncomfortable. So I understand that. So what you're about to see is me talking to my friends in New Jersey at Monty Hall. And this happened March 2016. And I think you're really going to, like it. And it's, I only do it once a year. And I just like thank all the friends who came out. I can't believe how many people were there. 10,000 people. You can probably on the video, it's going to look like, oh, there's maybe 100. But it's deceptive. Tens of thousands of people. It kept going in a column that stretched for literally miles. So here it is. And please enjoy my talk called The Genius of Travel.
In the beginning, the universe was empty. There was nothing except Tohu and Bohu, a comedy team. And Tohu spoke, and he said, "What?" And Bohu answered and said,
"What?
What?
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 What?" And this went on in a comedy way over and over again. But what they did not know is there wasn't two of them, but only one. And what they were hearing was an echo, an endless feedback loop. And they created a universe where the answer to every question is a question. Give us a call, 800-989-9368. Oh, I'm so glad to see you today. Oh, my goodness. Oh, it's so great to be here. It's so different than being on the radio. I don't know which is better. I like being on the radio because I can't see your faces. But I think this is better because I can see your faces. But there's things we can't do, and you're saying, "Oh, I feel the same way, Hardy. Usually when I listen to you, I'm cutting my toenails or eating durian fruit." So both, by the way, are prohibited here. And just as an aside, some trivia, and all of you who work here know this, there is a bathroom on the fourth floor that basically says no pooing. And I think it's very interesting. I think that's very polite. Now, all of you who are here have traveled to be here. And I think that's remarkable. You say, "No, I'm from Jersey City." Still, you have to travel. And it took you, wherever you live, I'm sure at least an hour. But some of you are from very far away. You're from other states and everything. You came, and that's great. And we have no award for you, anything. You know, when you go to one of those reunions, and there's a prize for the person who's come the farthest, and you think, "Oh, I've got this in the bag, right? I'm coming from California to New York City. Oh, I'm going to win." And then there's some guy who's an airline pilot who just flew in from Japan, and he gets the bottle of Chardonnay that you don't even want. And you're bitter about it, but it's no contest because travel is travel. And we all know that old kind of cliche that it's not the destination, it's the journey. Once upon a time, Xuanzi decided to visit his friend Dawei. So Xuanzi set out and he crossed a field and he came to a stream, and he took a raft across the stream, and he took the chicken and the sack of corn, and then he left the chicken, took the sack of corn back, got the dog. I might be confusing this with another story. Maybe it was just him. And I've ruined the riddle for you. And then he came upon a great forest, and he ate some mushrooms and got violently ill and started to hallucinate. And then he went over a mountain, and he had to battle some kind of pig god. And then finally came down into the valley where Dawei's house was, and he approached the house, and he walked up on the porch. And he was about to knock on the door when he turned away and started to walk home. And that's when the door flew open and Dawei says, "Where the hell are you going, man? I invited you to dinner. Why are you walking away? I got a whole pot of yellet millet on the stove." Why? Sean says, "Oh, I'm sorry. It's the journey, not the destination." Dawei's like, "No, when you said yes to RSVP to dinner, come on in, you fool. First of all, it's just a metaphor or something. The journey's just, it means, you know, it's the process. It's the asking the questions. It's not getting the answers that matter." He was right. The first time I ever really traveled, I mean, left the country or anything, my grandparents took me on a cruise. Now, the Nazis gave us a lot of bad things. But one of them is organized fun vacations. And that's what these modern cruises now. Now, back in the old days, sea travel was different. You know, you'd get on an ocean liner, you'd hop on in New York City, and then zip, just like that, a month later, you're in Europe. But these are all about the ride on this ship. You know, you're supposed to have fun on the way there, and the destinations don't really matter, and they're sort of depressing anyway. But this wasn't a modern cruise ship. It was sort of in the early days of cruising. They hadn't built them. So this one was an old World War II hospital ship that had been converted to a cruise ship. So what used to be an operating room was not a ballroom with a cheesy stage and a cheesy little band, not like they have now where they have, you know, celebrities like Fred Travellino or something. May his memory be a blessing. He's gone now, I think. But they had, you know, these ballrooms and everything in this weird thing. It wasn't very sophisticated. And I don't have a lot of memories of it. And one that I do is more or less based on a photograph. And the photograph is of me, I guess, at a costume contest. Now, I don't know if you know about this ahead of time, whether they tell you, or it looks like it was a makeshift thing. You know, they sprung it upon us. I don't have a costume. You just go through your stuff. Because I don't know what I was dressed as. And just been judging from my grandfather's taste, I think I was a hobo. Which even at the time, I felt, I'm a homeless boy? Yeah, just put this on. Now this was the costume. So I had a felt, kind of a floppy felt hat, which I don't know is particularly hobo-ish, but sewn to it were things like a toothbrush. And then my face was smeared with something black, I guess because I was sleeping in a coal pile or something. And then the strangest element was I was adorned with paper streamers and balloons, as if I was a mad hobo running amok through a party and gotten tangled up in these things. And the look on my small little 8-year-old face is one of absolute humiliation. And the MC is, you know, gleefully, yeah, grinning and mocking me. But one of the things I do remember about the cruise is the cruise went to Haiti. Right? I think you're tittering because you're like, that doesn't sound like a great idea. Right? You already see this coming, don't you? So the ship anchors off of, I think, Cap Haïtien, right? And everybody goes up on deck. And we're looking over onto the water, and these wooden boats come up with young boys in them, like my age. And I think, what's going on here? And they pull up to the boat, and then people on the ship start throwing pennies into the water, and the boys dive in and grab the pennies. And they're just laughing and throwing pennies. And I had this expression of saying, children like me, do I have to go get pennies and I'm all drowned? This is awful. And just the awfulness even then, once it started to hit me, it got worse when we got off the ship. And I was surrounded by young children begging for money. It was the most frightening thing I can imagine. And I begged, crying, to be taken back to the ship, because the cheesiness on the ship was far better. And I'd much rather blind myself to the realities of actual poverty. I was 8. I've never been a good traveler, and so I finally realized that maybe I need some help. Maybe I need to consult a book or something, and I found a book. This one. It's called The Art of Travel. I thought, oh, this is going to do it now, The Art of Travel. This is a great book. Now, it was written in the mid to late 19th century. So a lot of the things are iffy, but it is the most complete book about traveling, especially if you're going to do an expedition to Africa in the 19th century. But there's still useful information in it, and it is incredibly scientific and well-researched. So it has things in it, like say you're out in the wilderness, and you are with your horse, and you want to go to sleep, but you're afraid that maybe something's going to sneak up and eat you. So what you do is you lie down, and you tie your arm to the bridle of the horse, so the horse is sleeping, and then if the horse hears something, he'll jerk his head up, pulling your arm out of the socket, and awakening you. And I guess your terrified screams of pain will scare off whatever it is that's trying to get you. Or if you're cold, and in the manner of Scottish poachers, what they would do is, if there has to be 3 of you, and a field of heather, and 2 of you lie down, and you cover the other poachers with heather, and then you squeeze in the middle like that, and you're all comfy and warm, sleeping outdoors under heather, and eventually I guess you'll be trampled by horses, and it's got great information like that. Everything is measured. One of my favorite things is the author says, did you know you can use intestines as a belt? It may grow putrid and rot, so maybe you don't want to, but he has to point out every possibility. There's nothing left out in this book. Once in elementary school, I had to, it was part of a project where they said, okay, we're going to go outside and we're going to pretend that you're in different groups and you're stranded on a desert island, and what are you going to do to survive? So everybody started building, you know, like lean-tos, and I thought, I'll dig a pit. So my group, we dug a pit and put something over it, and I was mocked for that, for making a pit home. It's in there. It's got to be a very dry place. You can't, don't like, Central Florida or something would not be the place to make a pit home. But it has, it's amazing what's in here. You know, how to stuff a stomach full of food or something and take that with you. Oh, there's a, he measures different kinds of woods, tell you which one floats the best and everything. The instructions for making a flotation device are hilarious because it says, all right, take two pieces of canvas and cut them into sort of a donut shape, and now sew them together, fill them with some kind of Indian rubber. Come on, you're in the wild. You're talking about making a, that's a proper flotation ring. But what he wants to do is tell you what's best, what's the best thing to do in any travel situation. I decided to travel as an adult then, and I went to France. And while I was in France, I wanted to go to this museum in Lausanne, Switzerland, called the Musée de l'Art Brut. And what's that? What's that mean? It means Museum of Art Brut. Now, you still don't know what that means. So what's a brut? Well, it's somebody unsophisticated or mentally ill or something like that, somebody outside the mainstream, somebody a little weird. So I went to this museum, and it was amazing, it was eye-opening. Oh, the beautiful art that people had done. Crazy, crazy, crazy. These people's genius, really, was their insanity. And they made elaborate art, and it represented their feelings. And I was really captivated by one particular portrait. And it was a self-portrait of a guy, and it had the words written under it, Raymond Oui-Oui. Raymond Wee-Wee, Raymond Yes-Yes. And the little caption said, this is a mental patient who went around going, Wee-Wee, 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 Raymond Wee-Wee, Raymond Wee-Wee. I said, Raymond Wee-Wee. I like Raymond Wee-Wee. Is Raymond Wee-Wee better than Picasso, or is Picasso better than Raymond Wee-Wee? I have a time machine. And it's not a very good one. It's kind of old and rickety, and I really shouldn't use it. And time travel is different than regular travel because it isn't the journey that counts. The journey's awful. It makes you physically ill. It's really the getting there. You just want to get there, and then you can start the fun, right? So I decided I'm going to meet the guy who, I've got to meet the guy that wrote this book. So I went back, and I met him as a kid, little Frank. His friend called him Frank. Now, Frank was a really, really smart child. I mean, really precocious, doing math at age 2. At age 4, reciting Shakespeare. Is this a dagger I see before me, handled toward my hand? Come, let me clutch thee. I have. Well, that's a little hardy. He didn't talk like that because he lived in England. That's how I would do it if I were him. But he was very smart. And then I learned something really strange, that his grandfather was Erasmus Darwin. The same grandfather as Charles Darwin. They were first cousins. What an interesting family. And I had just talked to you about the Darwins and the Wedgwoods and everything yesterday. Well, it wasn't yesterday for you. Well, it was like a year ago. But it was yesterday for you. And if you look back, I'm wearing exactly the same clothes. It really was yesterday. So I followed this little boy around for a while, right, see what happened. I went back a couple years later, and he was really doing well in school. I found out that his grandfather and Josiah Wedgwood and Erasmus Darwin, all part of the Lunar Society, these were some of the top geniuses of the day. This was a concentration of brilliant people and great families like the world had never seen, right? And, oh, he was doing great. His grandfather made his money selling arms to Napoleon. Isn't that interesting? What a neat guy, right? His other grandfather's a doctor, and this one's an arms dealer. So then a terrible thing happened. When he was almost done with school, his father died. He was devastated. Oh, he lost his mind. Had a nervous breakdown.
Could not turn up all the way. Oh, no. Don't do that. Don't do that. Go back there.
Took an early dismissal without an honors degree. But something did happen. He inherited a lot of money. And he used that money to travel. And he went to South Africa at a time when people didn't normally do that. And he learned a lot, like not having water and things like that. Having all his cats. See, they would, on these expeditions, you would have to take live animals and things to eat, too. That's why he points out, if you're hungry and you don't want to kill the whole cow, you can just cut a chunk out of it. People did that. That's why the Bible says don't. It's a horrible, horrible thing to do. So he went and he traveled like that, and he gained even more knowledge, and he became even more and more obsessed with a couple ideas, and one was measuring and classifying things, and the other was the improvement of humanity. Again in France, I was in the acquaintance of two fellas that I was playing some music with. One's name was Philippe, and he was a great guy. He was a craftsman, and his specialty was taking big stone walls out of old buildings and everything like that, and without the building falling down. And the other fellow's name was Sam, and Sam was from Beirut, and he was kind of a happy-go-lucky hippie. And you don't think about that, and a Muslim. And we were driving one day down there. It was actually at nighttime, and we were going to a fellow's house to play music, and it was one of those French roads where there's plane trees on either side, so it's just a road. There's no shoulder, right? So if you veer either way, that's it. And we're driving down the road, and Philippe is talking, and Sam is rolling one of those special French cigarettes, you know, and they crumble up. I don't know, it was beef bouillon or something on it. You got to heat it a little first, and then it crumbles right on the cigarette. So we were all sharing the beef bouillon cigarette and driving down this road at night at a good clip and talking about various things. And Philippe was sharing things about his life, and he said, you know, I love driving, but it's slightly difficult for me. I said, why is that? And he goes, well, I'm legally blind. I had some glass explode in my face, and I see kind of shapes. I was like, oh, that's wonderful. And the conversation continued. And it was right after 9/11, so I was a little bit depressed, and they were consoling me. And Sam said to me, and in the most consoling voice, he said, oh, I know how it feels. You know, I'm from Beirut. You'll get used to it. You'll get used to it. I went back and got my time machine out again, and I had to go back and see what was happening with Frank now. And man, had this guy made some leaps. He was doing incredible work. This fella invented some things because of obsession with classification. He wanted to know why people are smart. He wanted to know why certain families produce geniuses. Where does genius come from? He was surrounded by all these brilliant people, right? So I got very interested in it. So he wanted to compare people. He was one of the first people to do twins studies, right? He came up with this idea, nature versus nurture. That's him. He invented that. And so he studied people and classified things. He invented the questionnaire. You could find things out about somebody, asking them certain questions. And he would sell them to people. People would come to him, and he'd give them a questionnaire and find out what they had the best aptitude for. Now, I remember doing this in high school one day. They said, we're going to take you to do a career aptitude test. And what you do is you answer some questions. Then we tell you what career is suited for you. I was very excited. I knew what it was going to be. And then I got that envelope. I got the results. And I opened it up, and it said, entomologist or librarian? And I said, no, astronaut. No, astronaut. I said, no, it's not. You're not suited to be an astronaut, librarian or entomologist. And I'm thinking, what could I have possibly answered on that test that made them think I like bugs? I like books, but I don't want to spend all day reshelving them and answer people's stupid questions and everything. Lord, but he's responsible for that, so he'd like to do that. He started trying to evaluate people based on fingerprints. He came up with that. He thought, well, maybe you can tell stupid people by their fingerprints. You can't. You can me a little, because I have a scar across here. And that's a very interesting story. I was opening a can of Underwood deviled ham. And you know, you open the can and then the lid goes, and it kind of sinks down a little. And you go, oh, I'll grab that. And I grabbed it and it went, you know, into my thumb like that. My grandfather screamed at me. I don't know why that was his reaction to blood all the time. Ah, you've got yourself! But so he studied fingerprints. He made weather maps. He coined the term anticyclone. He was obsessed with measuring. Now, this book is obsessed with measuring, too. He even wanted to test the strength of different ropes. So he went around to different stores in London, bought 5 different kind of ropes, and then did scientific tests to see which was stronger, just like Christopher Kimball testing spatulas. No, this one's spatula's the best. It was like the first product testing. Right? He did this with everything. It was an obsession, but because he was brilliant, he just kept going and going with it over and over, classifying people, comparing them. He wanted to see if you could inherit actual skills, if you could inherit that kind of genius, and he wrote a book about it. But I still think the most interesting book is this Art of Travel. Now, why is that? Because I started to see a pattern to this guy's thought, right? I started to see that he saw the world in terms of better and best and things like that. And I think we all do, right? We all see things in terms like that. We all want the world to be better. We all want people as a whole to be better. And he did too. And I always try to do that by traveling. And doing different things, even if they're a failure. When I was on another boat as a child, I was on one of these like 34-foot Chris Craft boats, and has a had to use the head. That's what they call it at sea. And so it was dark, and I went down to the head, and I went in. I closed the door, and it was almost pitch dark, and my eyes hadn't adjusted. And saw the toilet there, a dark circle before me. And so I started to, I'm not going to act it out. I don't know why I put my hands down there. I don't know how other to, I want to, if I was on the radio, this would be easy. I'd go ahead and my fly would be down and everything. But here I forget. You're just going to have to close your eyes and imagine it. Or I could stick my thumb out or something. So I was standing there. Let's pretend I don't use my hands. And I was standing there and started, and I did not hear the familiar sound of like water being poured in a basin. But what I heard was sort of a dull thud, like a, I wonder what that is. And, you know, you don't react immediately. And then I thought, that sounds like cloth. And then I realized far too late that the seat was down, and it had one of those fuzzy seat covers that was brown. And man, I'd saturated it. And it was one of those situations where you think, well, as long as I stand here, no one will ever know, right? If I don't leave, then it's okay, you know? I'll just see how long I can do it, or fake a heart attack or something. I was too young for that to be believable. Oh, my goodness. I hate embarrassments like that. But, you know, you're a person. And every time you go out, you take a chance, you're going to make mistakes. You know, not everything is perfect. You can't evaluate everything, can you? One of the most interesting things that Frank did is he wrote a letter to the editor of Nature. And it's entitled, Cutting a Round Cake on Scientific Principles. So he was very concerned that when you cut a cake normally, right, you take a piece out of the cake, you've got 2 exposed sides and it can dry out. So that's no way to cut a cake, right? So he did a little thinking, and being a genius, he came up with a better way to cut a cake. Now, this is, you're going to go home and try this. So if you're just listening, I'll have to describe it. So you've got your cake, your round cake right here, and what you do is you cut 2 lines here in the center, and then you just kind of slide out that rectangular piece. Those are your first pieces. Then you push those 2 sides up together, and you got a football shape. Now, you wrap that with an Indian rubber band. He was very obsessed with Indian rubber. I don't know whether he had stock in an Indian rubber country. I don't know why I don't even carry around a lot of Indian rubber with me, but it's always a main ingredient of any solution that he has. And then once you have the football cake, going horizontally, you cut two lines this way, and then you slide your other two pieces out, right? And then you're left with these that can all go together, sort of like that, and like a kind of a rounded circle. You got four pieces, so then that's your problem. You got to have four friends, hopefully have a party, to eat all four of those things. Now, that's brilliant and absolutely ridiculous. Who's going to cut a cake like that? All different shape pieces and everything, but that's the best way to cut a cake, isn't it? It's a brilliant solution to a problem that doesn't really exist. But I still find it extremely interesting. Now, the more I got to know Frank, the more I became a little bit concerned about his obsession with making everything better. He was a very spiritual man, though. He believed that everybody was one. We were all in it together, that the humankind, the human race, deserved to be lifted up and to be better. And what better way than encourage people who are smart, who are cool, to have more children, and people who are brutish and who are stupid and maybe violent to have fewer children? Now, that's a great idea. That's the beginning of the movie Idiocracy, isn't it? Mike Judge, oh yeah, we all agree with that. And I started to wonder about that because, you know, I know some brutish people and I love them. And sometimes the children of brutish people are awesome. I think, not me, I don't know. I didn't mean to make that. I'm not awesome, but I deserve to live, I think. At the very, very least, I deserve to be alive, right? Well, you know, that just started to disturb me a little bit about this idea about better, you know. And he had a name for it. It was great. He named it. He called it eugenics. His name was Francis Galton. Now, you think, oh, I've heard of eugenics. That's where you encourage smart people to have more children and dull people to have fewer children, right? Now, he never encouraged anybody to enforce this, right? And they never did in England, just the United States, where people like my cousin who had Down syndrome were not permitted to reproduce. And I like my, well, I mean, I like her, but she's just a person, you know, and she's very selfish and mean and sarcastic. But I am too. So we're just alike, or no difference. My first cousin, and I love her, and she passed away recently. And she did have a pretty good life. I gotta tell you, she's a good person, and I miss her. But, you know, this is the man that came up with this idea. And later in life, he wrote a very, very, very strange novel. And it was called Can't Say Where, with a K. One word. Where's that mystical place, Can't Say Where? And it was a strange novel. It was filled with his ideas. See, he actually came up with ideas in statistics, too, like the idea of correlation and regression to the mean, right? That's huge. This man, if this man didn't exist, there are some disciplines that wouldn't be where they are today. And yet, he may have come up with the worst idea of all time. That's what is better for everyone is better for every individual. This is simply not true. I will prove it. I think that the best breakfast is Fool Madamas. I'm not kidding you. I love it. Have you ever had it? It's mashed up fava beans. Ooh, it's a great way to start the day, mashed up fava beans. All right? Unless you have glucose 6 phosphate hydrogenase deficiency. Favism. No, it's not an artistic movement. It's not an artistic movement. It is a medical condition. We have low red blood cells, and they're affected by things like eating broad beans, fava beans. So while I may delight in eating fava beans, and they may be good for me, it is not the best thing for you if you have favism, I guarantee. However, if you have favism, you may have an immunity to malaria. And that is an evolutionary advantage, is it not? So your great defect might keep you alive. A lot of people get something wrong about evolution, that we're moving towards something. Even you hear that expression, oh, I'm evolving on that subject. Well, that doesn't mean anything. That could mean you're growing horns or something. That's absolutely meaningless. Doesn't mean you're getting better. The people responsible for that idea were Christians who were scientists around that time, men like Henry Drummond, who wrote a book called Scientific Law in the Natural World or something like that. And he was arguing, yes, evolution is consistent with Christianity, absolutely, because we're all getting better and becoming more like God, and we will eventually be eternal. No. No, that's not right. And even serious scientists sometimes misunderstand evolution as sort of working towards something or getting better or making some kind of ideal. And it is simply not true. We're just always changing. And don't ever confuse better with different. Oh, we're all different, but not necessarily better than one another. So if you ever feel, now how's that have anything to do with me, Hardy? Well, I guess I'm saying a couple of things. Eugenics is bad. It's a bad idea. But it wasn't invented by a hateful person. And there's a very unusual... This novel was never completed. It's just in fragments. And he jams a lot of his other science theories in there, too. It's completely unreadable. And one of the things when he describes the spirituality of the people of Can't Say Where... He said, there's one thing they like to do. And this is another thing that Galton invented. They like to superimpose photographs on one another of faces. More than one. And have you ever seen those composites? Like, this is an average face. And they put a bunch of faces together. And you have one bland. You go, this is the ultimate attractive person. Or something. And it's just this blending. I guess that's a face, right? Well, he came up with that idea, putting them together. He said, but the people of Can't Say Where, they do this as a spiritual exercise because they believe all the ancestors come together. We are all one. And so anything that we do for us as a human race, right, is good, right? Right? No, I'm afraid it's not. It's not. I'm not saying that some things aren't better. Like, I like some bourbons better than others. That's just my taste. There's some things that are better, and I'm not saying, you know, that there's not a good way to float a log. He's got some good ideas there, right? And he even mentions, now we all know this with Star Wars, he says, you know what makes a good shelter? A hollowed-out dead horse. You see, some of these things I'd rather die than do. And some of them are completely... So there's a section on how to fish without a line or without a net. And that is poison. So you poison the fish. You're laughing, but people do this, right? You poison the fish. And what he recommends are fish berries. They're aptly named, and they're incredibly poisonous to fish. They're sort of poison to people, too. Ah! But like he says, you can survive on rotten meat. So you poison the fish. Now, this is a great idea. Here's the thing. They only grow in certain parts of Asia. So if you are in Africa, where do you get your fish poison? So all these solutions are not universal. There are no universal solutions to these things. We all make our way as well as we can. Don't think there's any kind of standard that you need to live up to. Don't think there's any particular way that you have to be. I believe that Raymond Wiwi is as good an artist as Picasso.
and probably a better person. But would we, do we want more Raymond Wiwis or more Picassos? It's not for us to say. We can't engineer life like that. Science is wonderful, and it can describe things and make great solutions. It can heal people. It can send us to the moon. I don't know why we want to go to the moon. Personally, I'm not against it. I've never really figured out that we're on the moon. All right. Yeah, that's good. That took a lot of effort and money. Yep, sure did. Sure did. That's why we can only throw pennies to the Haitian children. Well, I've never been back on it. Well, I was back on a cruise ship, and I've only gone against my will because somebody, do you ever have family members make you do stuff? So I seriously don't want to go. So you're choosing your family, you're choosing something else over your family. Oh, Lord, please don't make me go. I don't like buffets. I don't want to do that or eye sculptures. I didn't really come here to talk about eugenics. You know, I literally got there by finding a travel book. And the travel book turned out to be absurd in a wonderful way. And I think it might still be in print. This copy is from 1970. So it could have been in print for over 100-some years. Can you imagine that? And it does useful information, and it really is a feat. The guy was an amazing thinker. But he had a really unusual quote, you know, for somebody like that. He basically said that with all his research and genius, he considered genius a sort of madness, somebody driven by one idea, and he was describing himself, and that it was the mistaken idea. A really bad idea that doesn't seem bad at all, because it seems like you want to help everybody, doesn't it? But oh, that can be toxic. That can be toxic in morality and ethics. Any rule that's for everybody, it just won't fit. One size does not fit all, especially my head, which is very tiny. I know it doesn't look tiny to you, but I cannot be fit. I went to a hat shop one time, and literally the guy was baffled. He's like, we're down to child sizes. I don't know. My brain is super dense or something, or just could be tiny. You know, chimps don't have a huge brain, but they're clever. And chimps would do better if they cooperated more and they worked together more and they overlooked their differences and their smelliness and their poo throwing and everything. We throw poo all the time. That's why when I speak to anybody, I don't want to tell you what to do or how to behave. That's why it always sounds like I'm hemming and hawing and everything. I've got no rules. When people ask me a question, I answer with another question because I think it's a process of getting somewhere. That's why I avoid certain words and things like that. Just, you know, I'll ask you a question, you ask me a question, and we'll go back and forth over a bowl of yellow millet. At Dawei's house. Don't you agree? Oh, my goodness. Whenever I see all your faces, I love it. I love it. I do get hypnotized. I'm not going to lie to you. That's why sometimes I'll just look into you. See, I'm just like looking in the middle. I can't look at any one person. And I think it's interesting how you fade away. And it is like those composite photographs, because the farther away you get, I know their faces. I just don't know whose they are. You know, they line up. And could you imagine all the faces through time, all stacked together like that, just like in his book, Can't Say Where. Oh, my goodness. An unusual thing about the book, too, is that he sort of decided ahead of time that there would be so many, because of his work in statistics, there would be so many stupid people and so many bright people, and then most people would be in the middle. Just like dropping beans, right? They all pile up in the middle, and then things go out to the edges. Could that be right? How could that be right? Why would there be an equal number of ignorant and smart, and what does even that mean anyway? Oh, don't bother to compare yourself. I can say that now because my life's been a mess, so I can make excuses. Do it my way. I never cared about anything. It didn't work out super great, but my soul is light. I don't worry about things. I stopped having to compare myself to people because of recurring humiliation. Because I have never, ever been out of that surreal hobo costume. I feel like I always have mascara smeared on my face, that I have balloons hanging from me and streamers, and people are saying, "What is that supposed to be?" Of course you're homeless. Who would give you a home? Silly little clown boy. And I don't want to judge people, but I think, if I remember correctly, the lady behind me won, and it was like a granny with a belly dancing outfit on. And I love all bodies. Now I love all bodies. I don't judge. I really... You know what I mean? People, and I get a little frustrated with people who are disgusted by bodies. I say, what do you think? I mean, what do you think? There's some perfect body or something? You don't think everybody naked looks silly and has moles and dents and things? Really, the idea that it's all perfect and beautiful is absolutely subjective, believe me. That's why they make different colored light bulbs. That's why when you first walk into a bar, you go, man, I can't see anything. That's by design. Because all you want to see, people in the bars are supposed to look like those composite photographs. You go, that's a pretty face. And it's not. Oh, I'm sorry to go off topic. I like to stay, make it sound like it's a beautiful poem or something, but there's a detail that I'd have to say about Charles Diamond. So... and I think it's sort of kind of weirdly telling. So fish berries. So apparently in England, they were making a paste out of fish berries, and they were sort of spiking beer with it. You know, the way they used to put nasty stuff in absinthe to make it a little more potent. You know, that's not the natural absinthe. It's pretty great. But they would put poison in it. That's why it was outlawed. Like copper or something. But they made this like paste, and then we put it in beer, and Darwin was outraged. He wrote a letter somewhere saying, this is not how you make beer. This is not the wholesome way to make wholesome beer, wholesomely. And he used like wholesome. He just kept using that word. And I thought, hey, I think Charlie liked his beer, maybe a little bit. Huh? But that was a fantastic family. It was hard not to think that those people were special, right? I mean, the Darwins, the Wedgwoods, the Galtons, they really were. But you know what? They all came from very humble backgrounds. I mean, the Daltons, all of them, they weren't born that way. The families, they learned. They developed values and all. You know, they worked at it. It wasn't just something that was inherited. They weren't special. And we know that from royalty. Ooh, if that really was true, then royalty would be, they'd be the best people on earth, wouldn't they? They wouldn't like all strangely look alike and not have jobs and I don't know what they do. I follow them on Twitter just to feel better about myself. I go, man, your clothes are sharper, but gee whiz, you know, you don't do nothing. All you do is pull velvet off of plaques and stuff. That's degenerate. So I guess, I don't know, I can speak to you from a position of weakness, which is great, right? I can take from a position of failure. I have some sort of authority because I'm so imperfect. I got nothing to prove. But those of you who are still struggling, who really have to go out there, right, and compare yourself to others, just keep that thought in your head, saying, I might be the one with favism who doesn't get malaria. The things that I do wrong, like I was working up in the marathon today, and I can't follow directions. When Ken speaks to me, I become hypnotized, and all I can think is, Ken's saying something important. Don't forget what he's saying. And he walks away, and I'm like, man, I'm glad that's over. I'm glad he's gone. But I have no idea what he said at all. And you know, I'm trying to think, how could that evolutionarily be a strength? You know, it might not be. It's the same thing. Fear is the same thing that made me want to stay in the bathroom and not admit that I had saturated the toilet cover with urine. Might work in the wild. So, oh yeah, that boy's going to survive. The boy with balloons and streamers on him. That's our future right there, that young man. Oh, I can't tell you what it means for you to come out like this and be together. And I feel like we're all together. I know I'm doing the speaking, but that's even if there was two of us, that would be the case. Shut up for a minute, please. I want to say a speech. That's the way most of us talk. Now my speech. Do you have any questions? No, I have no questions. I just would merely like to speak at you. But there is something when you're forced, forcing you to listen, and there's a nice convention for doing that, right? I stand up here and you have to be quiet. Well, you can yell insults if you want, but I prefer you didn't. But there's something that happens when we're all together. That's why we go to concerts. That's why people go to church, even if they're being preached something that's stupid. They get together and they know that there is a different energy when there's more than one person, right? My life as an individual is something separate but connected to my life with other people. And, you know, I can't always tolerate them, and I have to understand the difference is necessary or there wouldn't be people at all. That's how evolution works. Gotta have difference. Gotta throw everything out there, all the possibilities. So every single one of you is absolutely necessary. And that's hard to get through your brain, but you've got to do it. You might not be happier, but you'll be less depressed, maybe. That's what I go for. I'm very depressive. But I'm not shooting for happiness. I think that's unrealistic. You know, I will take little moments of joy, and I know that they are the product of my own delusion, and I don't mind that one bit. And I know I'm going to die eventually, and all of this is for nothing. And it really is a sacrifice of the individual for the greater whole and everything. But you know what? I'm not going to try to manipulate the greater whole. I'm not going to be Francis Galton. And you know what? He lived a long, long time, and he kept his wits the whole time. And he used to say, you know, oh, only the good die young. And then he added, but you know what? I still feel young. So even though I'm going to die at 90, I still consider myself pretty good. He never saw the error of his ways. He never realized that what he ushered in was one of the most poison ideas that we can have as people. So I hope when this ends, and will it end? Will it ever end? Yes, it'll end very soon. When this ends, what you'll take away with it is what you take away every time I speak, and that's absolutely nothing. And I'm not even being flippant. The whole point is just to be together and have fun, and I'm creating the illusion that I'm saying something, but really I'm not saying anything at all. Did you hear what I said? I said some things are better, but then they're not better, and then... Sounded cogent, didn't it? It's not the point. The best things are pointless. The best answers are questions. Am I right? Thank you so much for coming. Oh, sometimes. In the form of a question, please. Don't you think it's just sometimes? Don't you think it's like, whose line is it anyway or something? Just and you stop asking a question, you're disqualified. Oh, my dramatic ending. I stepped on it. I thought, and the most, let me try it again. And the best answer is to question. No, this time you be quiet. Is questions. The end. Thank you. Thanks. Thank you all. You're so beautiful. Thank you. No, you. Thanks for coming. I love it. Appreciate it so much. You're all amazing. You really are. Thank you very, very much. Thank you.
You've been listening to Miracle Nutrition with Hardy White on WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope. in Rockland County at 91.9 FM and worldwide on the internet at WFMU.org. Up next, Sinner's Crossroads with Kevin Nutt, so please stay tuned to WFMU.
Right there on my knee. Yes, I know. Oh, I'm glad I know. Good God, I've been home. And there's a reason why I don't mind telling the world about it. You know what I tell them? Listen, sure. One Thursday evening,
oh, I've been called
up, and he laid his hands on me.
Yeah, I've been called
up. Somebody, somebody out there, I know you've been born again.
Oh, I was with it.
Oh, yes.
Lord.